Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Southern-raised humorist Roy Blunt Jr. took the midnight train out of Georgia a long time ago to make a life well north of the Mason-Dixon line. But you cannot take the South out of the Southern boy, and definitely not out of Blunt's lifetime of humorous essays and exasperation over America's North-South incomprehension. In a new collection, he's hunting snakes, meeting Ray Charles, confronting his whiteness, considering the rapture, and looking always for the nation's overlap between North and South. Up next on Point, Roy Blunt Jr. on North, South, and In Between. Joining me now from Birmingham, Alabama, is Roy Blunt Jr., humorist, novelist, journalist, and columnist. You may know him from his regular appearances on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's the author of 20 books, the last of which, a big collection of his essays, has just been published. It's called Long Time Leaving, Dispatches from Up South. Roy Blunt Jr., thanks very much for being here. Great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What's up South?
What's up there? Well, actually, the first time I heard this expression was from Dwight White, who was a defensive end for the Pittsburgh Steelers and was an African-American person from Texas. We were talking about the South and the North and racism on both sides, and he said, you know what they say, it's all either up South or down South. And it seems to me that the North is not as different from the South in certain respects as it would like to be.
You're all about the overlap, you say, in this book, though in American culture and politics, there's places where that's obvious and places where it's not. Can you be about the overlap and still have the humor? I mean, do they work against each other?
Well, I think anytime you've got incongruous overlaps, it's an opportunity for humor. You know, if everything were cut and dried and separated, there wouldn't be much point in finding interesting clashes that you can then resolve with the annealing. When people ask me about what the uses of humor are, I always get overly solemn. I mean, I just think, but when people's notions of two different people's notions of the same thing arise together, it tends to be an opportunity for jokes.
Remind us of your story, Roy, and how you ended up South and North altogether in one life.
I was grew up in Decatur, Georgia, just outside Atlanta, which is a smallish town, but well within the penumbra of Atlanta, though we tend to think of Atlanta as being within the penumbra of Decatur. And so I went to Decatur High School and went to segregated public high school, and then went off to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, which was also segregated. We didn't have any we may have had some Asians. I don't know. We didn't have any black underclassmen and underclass folk. And so I worked, and this was in the midst of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
The Fisk students were out sitting in and picketing and getting arrested. And so I started writing for the Vanderbilt paper about trying to integrate the Vanderbilt student body, which was a lively debate. It shouldn't
no
have
doubt.
Been a lively debate.
but no doubt was.
People should have said, oh, yeah, great, let's do it. But, of course, they didn't. So there was all that. And then the year after I graduated, they did, in fact, start having a few black students. And so there was that. And then I went off up to Harvard to get a master's in English because I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I thought maybe I would be a teacher writer. But
sure.
Then I got, and I did get a master's in English there, but it was, I was used to writing about, denouncing racism, and it was kind of a falling off to start writing about, bird imagery for other graduate students to grade, so I went off and, but I wound up back in New York. I worked back at the Atlanta Journal for a couple of years.
Yeah.
As a columnist, and there again, there's lots of lots of horrible, but interesting racial stuff going on. And then I went up to Sports Illustrated because I wanted to get up to New York. And I worked, and then I've been living up north ever since.
And now you're ensconced in sort of semi-rural Massachusetts, western Massachusetts, out in the Berkshires and looking down south. When you look south, and you say in the book you love to go to the south as long as you know you can go north again. When you look south, what do you see these
days? And vice versa.
Yes, yes, yes.
When I look south, well, I don't know. I mean, I moved up. Where I live in the Berkshires is a lot like, is topographically a lot like North Georgia, really, up in the North Georgia hills.
A little colder in December.
It's a little colder all the time.
But topographically, sure.
Yeah, it's hills and crooked roads, and it's nice. It's pretty country, everybody always says. But there are too many months of winter up there. But I don't know. I look back south, and I want to get back. I like going south just so I can sound like a regular person when I go into the Stop and Shop, you know, and,
right.
Instead of sounding like, you know. I'm always sort of halfway conscious that I'm not from, when I'm in the north, that I'm not from around there.
Yeah, yeah. So take us in. This is a wonderful collection of essays. I mean, you're just putting the fork in all kinds of directions here. I enjoyed it a lot. And I wish you'd take us on a little tour of some of your themes. I love the rapture, lighten up. What are you sharing with us there, Roy?
Well, that's an example of something that people in the north think I should have to explain, the notion that... you know, which has made a lot of people lots of money, sold a whole lot of millions of copies of books, is these left behind books and movies, which are based on the notion that when some great second coming moment comes, all the pure believers will be sucked up out of their clothes and sucked up to heaven, where they will sit at the, I always want to say sitteth, but I guess that doesn't go with they. At the right hand of of the Almighty, and people are just upset that the people I know, you know, liberal media-centric folk that
right.
I hang out with,
right.
are just up in arms that anybody could believe that. How can they possibly believe that? It's unbelievable that they believe that. And I just say, no, they believe it. You know, they believe it. And the more you say it's unbelievable, the more they will enjoy believing it. Because that's exactly what you expect a non-believer to say.
Right.
So I say that to them. But then I share with them my sense that it's an unlikely scenario. For instance, this picture, this thing of, I don't know how many people it is going to be sitting there, stretched off to the right of the Almighty, just sitting there, all naked, apparently. I don't know. And for one thing, it seems to me there's going to be a lot of faction. I mean, people are going to get restless, and they're going to, because what they're doing, of course, one reason my friends are upset is that, according to the prophecy, the unbelievers will be down below being covered by plagues.
Having a miserable time.
Yeah. That's right. Locusts, frogs, boils, and I forget the other thing. Scars or something. No, scabs. Sores.
Yeah, you know, sores, no doubt.
So they'll be sitting there up there watching all these people covered with several layers, including me probably, covered with several layers of locusts and frogs and sores and boils. And that's going to get boring after a while, I think. And they're going to call for some... Wouldn't it be better? It seems to me that the Lord would cover them with some wildcats every now and then, or some snakes. And so you'd have the snake people separated. And somebody would point out that the frogs are eating the locusts. That doesn't work.
Stop that right
and
now.
And also, that's right. Also, there's the notion, which I don't subscribe to, but a lot of people do, that it is very hard to be a Christian, to stay a Christian, if you don't have any clothes on. And so that might be a problem, too.
You've also got a great one here on cruelty to Elvis, people taking out after Elvis, and you just got fed up with it.
Yeah, well, there's this review. Albert Goldman wrote a really nasty review, a really nasty biography of Elvis back some years ago, which I reviewed for the New York Times. And Goldman just took the position that Southern white people are tacky and got no reason to live, basically, and that Elvis managed somehow to
transcend. Does Elvis
transcend? That's a good public radio word.
Yeah,
managed to transcend his whiteness, and
jump the rails.
Not to say that there's not something to that, but. Albert Goldman just basically hated Elvis, and Elvis had a lot. And Albert Goldman performed a service in pointing out how tacky, in fact, Elvis's life came to be. But
With the $16,000 peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah,
in Vegas,
that, Albert Goldman thought that was just horrible. Elvis and some friends flew, from Memphis to Las Vegas or somewhere to get a certain peanut butter and jelly sandwich that couldn't be found anywhere else. It cost them $16,000. These days it costs even more than that, I dare say.
So as a son of the South, what do you say? All right, if you want to spend on it? Or
exactly. If there's a certain kind of sandwich that is more important to you than a certain amount of money, then you'd be a fool not to go get it.
Wonderful. Roy Blunt Jr.'s new book is Long Time Leaving, Dispatches from Up South. He joins us from Birmingham, Alabama. And Roy, right now we've got Amy calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to make comments on this because I feel very strongly about this. My husband and I are both Yankees by birth. I was born in Ohio, my husband in New York, and we spent much of our adult life before we moved to South Carolina in Boston, which is, very liberal, very, Yankee-fied, to create a word for you.
Right. So you went the opposite direction from Roy Blunt Jr. What did you find, Amy?
We were an absolute culture shock moving to South Carolina. We were here maybe 2 months, and we were ready to cash in our 401ks, sell our cars, and move back.
Why? What was so difficult?
It was we're definitely in the Bible Belt, and to be overcome by just the religious overtones of everything here, from, neighbors asking you to go to church with them to used car sales places having crosses on their signs. We were just like, where is this coming from? And the idea of racism and, the whole Confederacy is very, very strong, particularly in South Carolina.
It sounds like you stuck it out, though. You didn't go back to Boston. How long have you been there? What have you found now?
Well, we've been here 6 years now, and what was funny was that we were just about to move, and it was September. And September, October, and November are the most glorious months to live in South Carolina. And it was really hard to give up 75 degrees every single day for 3 months in a row.
The Sun Belt snags another one. Roy, what do you say to Amy? She just about went off the rails herself there.
Well, one thing I would pick out of that mix is that the idea of racism is not alien to Boston, but
yes,
Boston has often proved.
Its own story, yeah.
Right. But, yeah, I think churchiness is a problem in the South. People pressing you to one great thing about being a Southerner living in the North is that nobody keeps track of whether you're going to church or not.
And you're out of sight, out of mind.
I enjoy that freedom. My parents were pillars of the church, and I just didn't have it. Just wasn't in me to be a pillar of a church, and so I feel your pain in that regard. But I've been in Charleston, and it's a pretty place, and I have friends. Where in Charleston do you live?
Just maybe 15 miles outside the city, and what's funny is Charleston is often voted the most polite city in the United States, and I have found that just quite not the case. I find that they're very polite to you if you're a tourist.
And once your family, watch out.
No part of you.
So well, I'm sorry. I just don't know what to tell you. I wish you could find a place there that that feels more comfortable. But I think that Southerners ought to realize that they shouldn't push people to go to church. People don't like being pushed to go to church, and I hope some people in Charleston are hearing what you're saying.
But they want to save souls, Roy. Well,
no,
and they may believe it.
They want everybody else to have to get up early on Sunday morning.
Okay, maybe. Amy, thanks for calling. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio, and Ron, you're on the air with Roy Blunt Jr.
Hi, Roy. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you see, Ron?
I just had not an observation, but a kind of a life situation. I have a contractor that installed mechanical equipment, and I took a job down in Virginia, and my family, my wife and daughters all live in Michigan, where we've been living for 20 years.
Yeah.
And the South is really growing on me. The first couple trips I made down, I didn't like the way they drove. I thought they drove too slow. Everybody waved at me. I started to wonder if I was having a flat tire. And I'm in the Harrisonburg, Virginia area, and the South is really growing on me. I think that long term I'd like to be down there with my wife and then let the kids go where they may.
So you may make that southern migration along with a whole lot of the country. Roy, what about that? The whole country seems to be looking south for for jobs and for retirement and everything else. I mean, eventually, maybe everybody will be down there.
Well, but then there's global warming, which might turn that tide back the other way. I don't know. But a lot of people say to me that the South doesn't exist anymore, and that more and more of the whole country is becoming just one bland area where everybody talks like people on TV. But that just isn't true. I mean, you go to Minnesota, and then you go to Mississippi, and you know which one you are in either case. The South has still got a lot of identity, and some people like it, and some people don't. As we were talking about the overlap between North and South, it's certainly true that the South is that lots of Northerners are going south for the weather. But I hope they don't go south in July for the weather.
But does that eventually change the South? That migration of people, or is there something unchangeable there?
Well, it sounds like it hasn't changed Charleston based on this this lady's account.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's good to mix things up. I've always liked mixed company and mixed breed dogs, and I can't think of anything else I don't like mixed, except I don't like mixed coffee or mixed drinks.
Right? Okay, we take note. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Hal. Hi, Hal. You're on the air with Roy Blunt, Jr.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating. I just moved down myself from Western Mass, and a couple of things I would observe and ask Roy about what he thinks about. If I hear, I'm loving it. I mean, I'm in Nashville, which is, I admit, kind of cosmopolitan, and I met a friend of mine when I first moved here who was actually from southern Mississippi who said to me, man, when I grew up, the North was Nashville, man. So I was from, the Arctic Circle as far as he was concerned.
Right.
But I find it, I just love it down here, and I love the people down here. And but there's this problem that Southern guys have. If I hear one more guy in a bar who I'm having a great conversation with say, yeah, well, I know I'm just a dumb redneck. I mean, I don't really know it. I hear that a lot, and I don't know if that's just is that the media's fault for portraying me as some kind of uptight northerner and them as some, we hear the cartoon characters on TV with accents are supposed to be dumb or something.
Oh, you're onto one of Roy's big themes here. Roy, what do you say?
Yeah, well... I was once introduced in New York at the 92nd Street Y, and there was a panel discussion of something, and I was on the panel, and I was introduced as the world's most sophisticated redneck, which is kind of
loaded.
I didn't like it. Yeah, I mean, they just toss people in the North toss around the terms redneck and Bubba and stuff more loosely than they would toss around any other ethnic terms that they don't know anything about. But you're right that people in the South, white guys in the South, often for instance, white comedians in the South will use the term redneck as if it's. But of course, it's one thing for a member of an ethnic group to use an ethnic term about himself or herself than for another. Somebody from the outside use it. And it could well be that these guys in bars are testing you a little bit to see if you say, yeah, you are a redneck, aren't you? Geez, I've always wanted to meet one, aren't you? Do y'all actually get married to each other and things?
Right.
I would suggest that sometimes Southerners are being a little more tongue-in-cheek than outsiders realize.
Hal, thanks for your
call. But redneck is originally meant a person who works out in the sun and gets his neck red, and so it's sort of rural guy. And the good old boy, that's always been, good old boy used to be, people would say, he's a good old boy.
Yeah.
Like you might say, this is a good old truck. It's really held up well for me. But now, good old boy just is this kind of term, and it's been, you shouldn't toss that term around either, because it objectifies people, and when a man objectifies himself in a bar, I would maybe edge away a little bit from him.
Roy, you write in this collection that you went north for the Enlightenment, capital E, originally,
right.
And now you look back on your years in the North and your visits there, and you clearly still see something in that kind of northward tilt of that, but you're critical in both directions, sort of, I don't know, closed-mindedness in the South, self-righteousness in the North. Is it, can you characterize the polarity that way?
Well, the philosophical basis of this book, I think, is I went up looking for the Enlightenment, which is a rational approach to experience, and because I just thought everybody I was growing up with was insufficiently rational. But the more I hang out with rational people, I realize that rationality has its limits, and that there's a joke about the old Southern boy who said was asked if he believed in infant baptism, and he said, "Believe in it? Hell, I've seen it done." Which I think is more profound than a lot of people realize, that everybody's sense of reality is based on a mixture of faith-based and reason-based and evidence-based. And I think that that people who are, John Kerry is an example of a rationalist candidate who thought he could just say, just exist on a rational level, and pretty soon he wasn't even being rational. The main thing is to be visceral, I think, and to convince people that you are somebody rather than that, and that you can. W.B. Yeats said, "We cannot know the truth; we can only embody it." And I think the South. Sometimes that's why the South tends to produce national presidential candidates, is because those candidates tend to be more embodied than just abstract.
Have you come back around full circle then? You say you write that early on you read the New Yorker magazine. You say it was a revelation.
Right.
As far as you could see in those pages, there was no civil war or crucifixion or nobody went to church. People made cutting little civilized funny remarks. But now you're saying, as far as you can see, the visceral is what ultimately drives things. Have you done the full circle?
Yeah, visceral drives things, but you got to temper that with rationality. It's like the market. You can't just say let's let the market handle everything. You got to temper the market with a little governmental control. And I feel the same way about viscerality and rationality. That's what when I talk about the overlap between. North and South, obviously these are very reductive notions of North and South, but I think that Northeast at least, does tend to be rationalist. And, you read the New York Times, and it's as if we can explain everything and get everybody on the right page here, and if we just all see the logic of things, we can move right along. But, in fact, human affairs don't proceed that logically, and the South, it's sort of that the notion that you can be objective about objectively logical has been debunked by postmodernism. Right. And the great thing about the South, or the interesting thing about the South, is that the South never believed that in the first place.
So it was the leading edge all along?
No, it's always been the trailing edge. But sometimes you have to, value the trailing edge.
You quote Henry Adams in your front piece here, saying the Southerner has no mind. What do you mean by putting him up front saying that?
Well, and then right under there, I say it's all either up South or down South, which is to say that, I think that Henry Adams, this was in the Education of Henry Adams, he was talking specifically about Rooney Lee.
Robert E. Lee's son,
mm-hmm. who was a classmate of his at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an example, I think, of Northern prejudice, because I know a little bit about Rooney Lee, and he was a big old boisterous boy, and not a great abstract thinker. But to say that he has no mind is a little harsh. But also, I think Dwight White said, it's all either up South or down South. The notion that the North consistently does have a mind is limited too. I think that, and that's what I've been trying to. Trying to write about. In fact, a very nice review in the New York Times Sunday suggested that George Bush was the very example of the person like Rooney Lee, Henry Adams said about Rooney Lee that the Southerner has no mind. He is all temperament. It's sort of like, it's a sort of good old boy thing.
Christopher Dickey came in with the Times there, quoting from Henry Adams' work, saying, strictly, the Southerner has no mind. He has temperament. He was not a scholar. He had no intellectual training. He could not analyze an idea. He could not even conceive of admitting to. But in life, one could get along very well without ideas if one only had the social instinct. There's Dickey quoting Adams, and which you've put right in the front of your book. So, but is that for real? I mean, Are there Southerners such prisoners as that? Do Northerners really have that kind of lock on logic, or is that just...
No, that's my point, is that Northerners don't have a lock on logic, and often Southern logic, like, for instance, that joke, believing in hell, I've seen it done. Mm. I actually told that joke once on Prairie Home Companion, and there ensued a long discussion on the Prairie Home Companion website of people who didn't understand that joke and wanted somebody to explain that joke to them. And I think that was sort of that joke went beyond logic. You know, there's the Mobius strip, when you take a little strip of paper and twist it once and then glue the two ends together, and run your hand along the surface, it only has one side. And I think that's sort of a Mobius joke, and that logic has to yield sometimes to the contrariness of the nature of existence in the universe, that the Northeast and the people who nominate John Kerry ought to take a little step back and study the Mobius strip a little more than they do their belief that you can just end a war right now by standing up and saluting in the convention.
Hell, I've seen it. Believe it, hell, I've seen it done. That's it. Yeah. The love of language that comes through in here is just wonderful, Roy. And you look at the South as a kind of anchor holding the fort for metaphor and juicy language.
Yeah, so I mean, all American, distinctively American popular music has come out of the jazz, the blues, country, gospel, all that stuff comes out of the South, and it's all a lot better than logic.
We're talking this hour with humorist Roy Blunt, Jr., about America's South and America's North, where the twain meet and where they do not. His new collection of essays is Long Time Leaving, dispatches from Up South. He joins us today from Birmingham, Alabama. You may know him from his very regular appearances on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And Roy, there's a lot of people who want to talk with you. Let's take a call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Cord, you're on the air with Roy Blunt.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I am a what is called down here a damn Yankee, because I was born up north, came down to visit, and actually stayed. This weekend I actually proposed to my girlfriend, who was a born and raised North Carolinian. She accepted. And I wanted to ask...
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm in favor of mixed marriage. I think it's a great thing. All marriages are mixed, actually.
But unfortunately, her father is not absolutely crazy about her marrying a damn Yankee. And I wanted to ask Roy's advice on what he thought I could do to possibly get him to, I'd say, warm to me maybe a little bit better and maybe avoid some problems in the future.
Soften up a little. What do you say, Roy?
Well, fathers-in-law have a certain resistance to sons-in-law everywhere, I think, and the regional aspect may not be the main aspect. So you could bear that in mind, I think, and just sort of be yourself. I think that people making an effort to be different, or just puts people off balance. So that I think transcends regionalism, is the father-in-law, son-in-law issue. But I'm hearing from people, northern people in the South, that they're really worrying about this too much, maybe, and I think you can kid back and just hold your own, and southern people will appreciate that.
So kid both ways, Cord, and hope it works out. Good luck with the marriage, and thanks for calling. Let's get a call from Nashville. Randy, you're on the air with Roy Blunt Jr.
Oh, thanks, Tom, for taking the call.
Yeah.
Grew up in Nashville and traveled around a lot. When I go up north or out west, try to downplay being a Southerner. But then moved to Scotland and lived there a few years, and the Scots love Southerners. So I realized, embrace who you are, but you don't have to be the stereotype. And I think that's kind of maybe what you're saying in some of these things, too.
The Scots love Southerners. Yeah. So you went back to kind of the old country and got embraced. Yeah. What do you say, Roy?
Well, lots of, white Southern stock derives from Scotland, mm-hmm. especially Northern Scotland, mm-hmm. Highland Scots.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes some sense, I guess. Yeah, I think that's true, is that you don't want, if people do react towards you as if you are a stereotype, you don't want to reinforce that. You want to try to be as slippery as you can and say things to them that put them off balance. You know, I, for instance, when people talk to me as a Southerner, you call me a Southerner, I say, well, you mean I'm a white Southerner, by the way. And they think I'm being, but in fact, that's a good point, because people in the North tend to think of Southerners as white Southerners. And in fact, Southerners are black Southerners too. And so if you bring that up to them, it throws them off a little bit.
That would do it. You've got an essay in here, Coming to Terms with My Whiteness? Was that it?
My Whiteness, yeah.
To take us into that, Roy.
Well, there's this. I was at a conference at Vanderbilt in Nashville, my alma mater, writers conference, and an African American scholar and poet named Natasha Trethewey suggested that white writers said black writers are always having to talk about their blackness. White writers ought to talk about their whiteness. Ought to face up to it. So I faced up to mine, and it was very useful. For instance, it made me sort of. There are all sorts of. I mean, it used to be that. I mean, white Southern writers have tended to. Make the same assumption that a Southerner means white Southerner. Mm-hmm. For instance, people used to say, when we were asked why there's so many Southern writers, white Southerners used to say, because we lost the war. And I was actually in another panel discussion one time when an African Southern woman stood up in the audience and said, I didn't lose the Civil War.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, it's like, what
hello.
Do you mean? That's right. What do you mean, we?
We.
Yeah, right. Right. So, and I think that's a good point. That, and in fact, I didn't lose the Civil War either. And I might have helped lose it if I'd been alive at the time, but I didn't lose the Civil Rights Movement either because I was for it. So I think there's lots of, so you got to expand your notion of who's Southern, and white people and black people mix. I mean, this Southern culture is just an inextricable mixture of black and white.
And Roy Blunt Jr. there facing up to his whiteness. Let's take a call from Lizette in Fall River, Massachusetts. Lizette, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and my father is from Louisiana, and my mother is from Europe. And they have since moved back down to New Orleans for the last about 15 years or so. And going down there to visit them from college, I remember always feeling so different and hating it because I just didn't understand the culture. And now, of course, since then, I've really come to embrace it and love it. Even though I still live in the North, I go down there often. And my father is also a huge Roy Blunt Jr. fan.
Great.
Oh, great.
I just ordered your book for him for Father's Day.
Hey. Oh, good for you. Yeah, it's coming up. It's coming up. Listen up, America.
Right.
Yeah,
there's the word. So what is it that you find you love now, Lizette, when you go south?
I love the difference. I love how, and you know, unfortunately, since Katrina, New Orleans has lost a lot, but there's still a wonderful culture there, and the pace of life is so different. And the food is fabulous, and the music, and the people.
Yep.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful culture.
Yeah, New Orleans, of course, is different from, say, Birmingham, where I am now. New Orleans is different from everywhere else. New Orleans is a wonderful place, and I might mention that anybody wants an easy way to do some good is to go down to New Orleans and spend some money. You can do good and misbehave at the same time.
Right.
And they need it. That's wonderful. Lizette, thanks very much. Roy, you came north and you write, you know, read a little on your philosophical journey, read a little Kant, and you quote him here in your introduction saying, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can ever be made. You say, in the northeastern circles I generally find myself in, people find that objectionable. Back home, they find it obvious. Take us into that. Why? What do you mean?
Yeah, well, I think that human nature is not very straightforward and not very. It's crooked. Human nature, you know, it's like playing golf. You have to hit a straight lick with a crooked stick, and that what makes life interesting. And the notion that you can just figure things out abstractly and not try, and then the job is then done, and all you have to do is keep saying it louder and louder, is antithetical to the South. The South is too accepting of the twisted timber of humanity, I think, and has had to be pressed by the North to, for instance, to give up segregation. And so the, you know, logical people have a great role to play in American History and culture, but but there's still but then, for instance, Civil War was supposed to be this logical. Mm. I mean, we look back at Civil War as pro-slavery and anti-slavery fighting it out, but it was a lot more complicated than that. Though the issue was slavery, the main issue was, but it was a lot more complicated than that. And also, after the war was over, they still hadn't solved slavery. I mean, it had been solved. Mm. Legally, but not culturally, and we're still working on it. And the South, I mean, that's just an example of how difficult things are to sort out. And the South can get complacent about that, but the North can get shrill about it.
So from your great straddle, or I don't know, home on both sides of the line, how do you see, if it's possible to say, there is a kind of a media culture and a political culture, certainly, if there's a contest here, or if there's a ratio, is the country become more Southern with its several Southern presidents, with the rise of religiosity? Do you see a more Southern country generally around you, Roy Blunt Jr.?
Well, the South has clearly had a big impact on I mean, when I was when Jimmy Carter got elected president, it was just astonishing that somebody from Georgia could be elected president. And but since then, it's always Southerners competing for the thing. Now we got, I've forgotten the numbers, but it's all, seven out of the last nine, if you include Al Gore.
A lot.
Who've been elected would be from the South. But I don't like to count George W. Bush in there. I think he's Connecticut in his roots. And a real Texas president would have been a little more deeply rooted and would not have been swayed so radically by the logic of Wolfowitz and the people who pushed him into war.
But you do put him down. You have fun a little bit with what you call the age of dither, which you kind of tag on the North, and the age of zeal, which you tag on the South. And you put George Bush's administration in the age of zeal category.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he had this simplistic notion and just went for it. And the South likes to do that. The South likes to root, likes to have a college team to just wear funny hats about and jump up and down and say, "How about them dogs?" And, that sort of absolutist loyalty to a cause, whether it's right or wrong, is there's a lot to be said for that. And if a country doesn't have that, the country's not going to hang together. But you can be way too simple-minded about that and get into trouble. And Bush has been way too simple-minded. I mean, Ronald Reagan was not that simple-minded. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sounded simple-minded, but he was wary of getting into trouble. Whereas Bush has lacked that kind of second layer of consciousness that enables you not to go overboard.
Roy Blunt Jr. saying he would advocate for an age of allowances and edging ahead, never mind dithering or zeal. Let's take a call from Newport News, Virginia. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the fact that I grew up in Newport News, Virginia, but my whole family is from Middle Tennessee.
Okay.
And whenever I go down there to visit them, I'm always the Yankee, and they make fun of my northern accent. But then I went to college up in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And there's a whole lot of students that go there from New England and Philadelphia and places like that. And they always said to me, you're such a Southerner. You're such a hick because I say y'all and everything. And I just wanted to...
How do you see yourself, Emily? Have you spanned the two or are you one or the other?
Well, I generally tend to side with my family and consider myself a Southerner. I pulled for the Tennessee Volunteers, even though I don't watch that much football. So, but I have a lot of affection for the South, but I do think that it has a lot of a dark side that it needs to overcome, with its history.
Yeah, Emily, we got it, and thanks for your call. Roy, let me get one more from Columbia, South Carolina. Tony, you're on the air with Roy Blunt, Jr.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Roy.
Hey.
Y'all doing okay today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Roy. When I go to other parts of the country, and I'm born and raised here in the South, I get an awful lot of the stereotyping. Is there any way to break the stereotype of the Southern white male when you're visiting and living in other parts of the country?
Well, I think, you know, if it's joshing, you can josh back. And but if it's insulting, you can say, now, wait a minute, that hurts my feelings. I don't think people realize that they're being stereotypical. I mean, I think people in the North feel they have a license to be stereotypical toward white Southerners. And you have to say, now, wait just a minute. You're not talking about me there. On the other hand, we are hearing from people on the phone here who are saying that Southerners feel they have a license to be that way toward Northern immigrants. So I think you have to stand up. I tend to argue with people. Southern people have a hard time, I think, getting on their high horse. Because once we get on our high horse, we tend to pull out our sword and charge.
Right.
So to be just sort of get up on your medium horse is not easy. And I think that's a challenge. And that's one reason there's no Southern Anti-Defamation Society, you know. But I think I'm working on this horse metaphor now, even as we speak. Maybe we should find some medium-high horse we can get on. That's what this book is designed to be, is a medium-high horse that doesn't lead to a cavalry charge, but does lead to making a few points.
Tony, how do you know when it's happening, when that stereotyping starts to come on? What are the first signs?
I love your accent. This kind of thing. And I think a lot of the ribbing that people from the North that come South get is reactionary to that. And mostly, I think it's mostly media portrayals of the South. You're either a backwoods hick, or they want to portray you as some kind of effete antebellum aristocrat if you attempt to be a Southern intellectual.
One way or the other. Yeah. Tony, thanks
people
for
say, it. Yeah. Yeah, well, people say, tell me they love my accent. I tell them, well, I like yours too.
That's great. Tony, thanks very much for your call. Roy, our time is short. You're standing up for the overlap here. Give us a little definition. If we've got a big national overlap between the different cultural backgrounds, what is it? What would you point to? What's the overlap?
Well, we were talking about the twain shall meet or not meet. One overlap is Mark Twain. He came from the South and wrote the great American novel, or the novel that Ernest Hemingway said was, the book from which all modern American literature springs. And Mark Twain mixed the vernacular, lots of forms of Southern vernacular, with formal English to create the basic default American narrative template. And therefore, there should be ways to talk to find the overlap, and there's a lot. I mean, music, American rock and roll is the overlap. The blues is the overlap. So if you can somehow carry that into conversations between people of the North and South, maybe I think that a lot of people in the North think that that Southerners are sounding like Southerners out of sort of perversity or something, or trying to sound like a stereotype. And you can just point out that I do this every day in the North. People say, well, I see you've kept the accent. And I say, yeah, why not? I like it. That's the way I talk.
It's yours.
Yeah.
It's yours, and it comes across just beautifully right here and in your essays. Roy Blunt, Jr., we thank you for the new collection, Long Time Leaving, Dispatches from Up South. It's good to have you right here. Write some more and come again soon.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to have you. Roy Blunt, Jr., the new collection is Long Time Leaving. We'll go out with Randy Newman and Old Kentucky Home. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.